Thank you, Bob. Well, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for being here for this program focusing on our most important resource in our community, water. I'd like to recognize Mike Burke and the San Antonio Clean Tech Forum for everything they do to educate and advocate in San Antonio. Truly, you're building the community of the future by focusing on issues like the water energy nexus and opportunities presented by a smart grid. Water issues, as has been noted, have been in the spotlight recently. And from the beginning of October through November 18th, San Antonio residents will be able to weigh in about our water future at 9 different specially called hearings across the city, with dozens of more public meetings scheduled as well. And then on November 19th, the City Council will consider a SAWS rate restructuring and adjustments that will enable us to move forward with construction of Vista Ridge and expansion of desalinization projects and with our EPA consent decree compliance. The new structure, of course, will also encourage conservation by our residential users. As a community, we are strongly committed to conserving, diversifying, and enhancing our water resources to ensure an abundant supply for our region's future. Water is a hot topic right now, and that is, of course, a good thing. If everyone in San Antonio thought about water and our future as much as the folks here in this room, we'd be assured that San Antonio will not only be able to meet our own needs, but will take our rightful place on the national and even global scene as a leader in water innovation. Already, we lead the nation in residential conservation, and we're building the largest inland desal plant in the United States. So there are tremendous opportunities for us. Securing our water supply, we're also improving water quality, we're developing innovative green infrastructure, and adapting smart cities technologies to manage our water system, whether that's dealing with stormwater, recycling, or conservation. For example, the city is currently working with stakeholders like the Greater Edwards Aquifer Alliance, developers, and the San Antonio River Authority to review and amend Article 2 of the Unified Development Code in order to support low-impact development practices, promote conservation, and improve our water quality. Nowhere in our community is this issue more important than in shaping a new integrated approach to stormwater management and environmental restoration. Now, if you would just put on your imagination cap for a minute, imagine that the hundreds of miles of concrete drainage channels in our city that we saw highlighted on the news this weekend are replaced with bioswales that filter and slow down runoff, while adjacent trails offer a real public health benefit to walkers and bikers. Imagine that trail lighting is enhanced with sensors monitoring access and environmental conditions ranging from rainfall to air quality to trail usage. Imagine that neighborhoods throughout the city are connected by these paths and that most San Antonians live within a few minutes walk of these creekways. Imagine the public health, environmental, and economic benefits that that could bring to our community. Well, we don't have to just imagine it. We actually can build it. Working with our city's Office of Sustainability and a new urban designer that we're going to be hiring at the city through the Envision American Grant Program with the assistance of major supporters like IBM and Cisco, my office is developing a green print for this trail network using the current and soon-to-be expanded taxpayer investment in the Howard Peak Greenway Trail System. And I saw Mayor Peak. I think I don't have my glasses on. I thought I saw him. When I advocated to expand the sales tax funding for the Greenway System this past May, I had such a network in mind, and it is a natural outgrowth of the efforts of so many of you in the room here today. In fact, many of the nominees for this afternoon's award have been instrumental in developing these ideas and approaches. Now, rebuilding our infrastructure to improve water quality and quantity while dramatically enhancing our quality of life here in San Antonio does sound like a tall order, but I'm confident we can accomplish these actions because SAWS, our municipally owned water utility, is the national leader in achieving conservation and working with agencies like the EPA Our local river authority here has pioneered low-impact development, other sustainable development practices in our community. And groups like the Clean Technology Forum have built a constituency for progressive change. And so when our city council votes on November 19th, I know you'll be there supporting our investment in the future. And when voters cast their ballots on our 2017 bond packages, I know that you'll be there as well, advocating for innovative approaches to conservation and stormwater management. So I'm looking forward to the rest of the program and stimulating dialogue on how we can advance all these exciting efforts and secure our water future. Thank you for allowing me to be here, and thank you for your leadership on this key issue. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mayor. That was a great setup for our panel. We have a very strong panel of local, regional, and state water experts, and I'm going to bring them up right now, and we'll take just a minute to move the podium away and get set up. But we're really pleased to have with us today Beck Brune, who is the board chair of the Texas Water Development Board. He's served on the board since 2013, and he was appointed chairman by Governor Abbott in June of this year. Chairman Brune, come on up. Robert Puente needs no introduction to this group, but he's president and CEO of SAWS, a position he's held since 2008. He started in the Texas House of Representatives in 1991, and in 2003 became chairman of the House Natural Resources Committee. That was, incidentally, during that time period that the Edwards Aquifer Authority was created. Mr. Puente, welcome. Councilman Ron Nierenberg was elected to the District 8 seat in 2013 and reelected earlier this year. He also serves as chairman of SA Tomorrow, Mayor Ivy Taylor's long-term planning initiative. Councilman. Dr. Andrew Sampson is the executive director of the Meadows Center for Water and the Environment at Texas State University in San Marcos. He's the former head of the Texas Parks and Wildlife and the former Texas State Director of the Nature Conservancy. Andy Sampson, coming up. Laura Huffman is the current Texas State Director of the Nature Conservancy. And as a former Assistant City Manager in Austin, the City of Austin, and Deputy City Manager for the City of San Marcos, she played key roles in water management for both of those cities. Laura Huffman, that's our panel. Give us just a minute, we'll get going. I think Mayor Taylor did such a good job of setting things up. We are in a very newsy environment right now between the last days of October and the City Council vote on November 19th. There will be 9 public hearings between now and then on a variety of these issues. But basically, I think the public conversation centers on a couple of key matters that we'll explore in detail here with our panelists. One is water diversification. SAWS has had a comprehensive diversification plan for some years. That led a year ago this week to a unanimous City Council vote to approve the Vista Ridge pipeline deal. That's still being much discussed and much debated despite that unanimous vote a year ago. And, of course, our conservation. SAWS has always been noted. It's been a national leader in the field of conservation, but it also committed at the time of the Vista Ridge deal to redouble the utility's efforts to find even more ways to conserve water. So much to talk about locally. But let's start at the state level. Commissioner Chairman Brune, we're glad to have you here today. And we're interested in the perspective from the Austin viewpoint of all these regional issues in San Antonio. So we'll give you the first word.
Well, thank you for having me. It's great to be in San Antonio. I've served as chairman of the Texas Water Development Board since June. However, I've been a board member with the Texas Water Development Board since September 1st, 2013. And I like to usually start in any discussion about our agency, what we do, with some reference to drought, because it really is going back to when our agency was created in 1957. We were created at the time as a result of the drought of record in the 1950s. Fast forward to the 90s and the passage of Senate Bill 1 in 1997 that established our state water plan and the process for how the Texas Water Development Board creates the state water plan. That occurred based as a result of drought at the time. Fast forward to just a few years ago in the passage of House Bill 4, which did a few different things, one of which was to reconstitute the governance of our agency, and for the first time in our history, established three full-time board members to do our job, but separately established a new fund that we call the State Water Implementation Fund for Texas, or the SWIFT, that voters approved a $2 billion capitalization of the fund with the passage of Proposition 6 in November 2013. And I would suggest that the result, or the reason for House Bill 4 and Prop 6, and to a large extent the overwhelming support statewide for passage of Prop 6 was 2011, which we now know was the worst one-year drought in recorded Texas history. So drought is a big part of who we are, what we do, and why we do what we do, which is one of the main functions is that our agency serves as a water infrastructure bank. We have financing programs available for local sponsors of projects across the state, whether it's SAWS or different cities, river authorities, to come in, borrow funds from the board in ways that allow them to implement new water supply strategies. Whether it's drought or whether it's what we've come to understand is significant population growth or projected population growth, our state water plan projects that our state's population is expected to nearly double between now and the year 2060. We understand that we all have to do more to find new and innovative ways to develop new water supplies. And so that's what we do. I'm always pleased to be in San Antonio sitting next to Mr. Puente here, because SAWS and San Antonio, I think, is a sterling example for the rest of the state when it comes to finding new innovative ways to diversify water supply, which I think is hugely important moving forward. So I think statewide we certainly have a lot in the way of challenges and making sure we keep up, but the Texas Water Development Board will continue to be a resource to allow us to be able to do so.
Well, thank you. And Andy, let me go to you next. You're a little bit closer in San Marcos than Austin. At the last water panel we had, I think you said that you've never seen a water deal that didn't make someone angry, and that Vista Ridge wouldn't be any differently. So how's it worked out?
Well,
you might get the microphone a little closer,
Bob,
to you.
Thank you and Mike Burke for having me today. We all love San Antonio. I think someone told me years ago that every Texan had two hometowns, and San Antonio was one of them. And I certainly feel that way as a former resident. We've all heard of not in my backyard. This is not out of my backyard. But it shouldn't surprise us that in a state that has 60 inches of rainfall in the east and less than 10 in the west, that we would have been talking about moving water around the state for almost 100 years. It's not only an issue of east to west, though. It's like upstream and downstream. This water crisis that we're in has exacerbated problems between growing metropolitan areas upstream and agricultural interests downstream. And I only need to point to the Colorado and the Guadalupe as examples of that. It's an issue that increasingly pits urban Texans against rural Texans. When, as Chairman Bruhn mentioned, the Water Development Board was formed after the drought of the 1950s, which we used to call the drought of record, everyone in Texas lived in a small town or on a farm or a ranch, and today that's completely reversed, and we're the most urban state in the country. Finally, the most exacerbated conflicts in the future will be between groundwater and surface water, because the state has basically told citizens in interest since we were a colony of Spain that surface water belonged to the public. Recently, the courts have reaffirmed that groundwater belongs to private citizens. And if everyone, I'm sure, has seen the diagrams of the hydrologic cycle on the projector here, it's the same water. And yet, if your children are asking you what to do when they get out of school, tell them to be water lawyers, because there's going to be a whole lot of litigation ahead of us. This state is going to double in population in the next 50 years. Some of the counties adjacent to where we are today will grow by as much as 300%. And yet we've already given permission for more water to be withdrawn from most of our rivers than is actually in them. So we are going to be transferring water around. We really don't have a choice. But what is going to have to happen is for us to begin to think regionally, to act as cooperate on a regional level to make sure that our projects are equitable to all. We need to institutionalize and embed in projects water conservation as a formal part of the projects. And finally, to incorporate in projects which stimulate growth, additional projects to conserve the landscape, which will be adversely affected.
Well, thank you. Laura Huffman, some people are philosophically opposed to moving water from one water basin to another. That seems to be the case in the Vista Ridge deal, where critics are worried about the future of the aquifers in Burleson and Lee counties, and just philosophically opposed to moving water 142 miles by pipeline. But is Andy Sampson right that this is the first deal in the state of this nature, but it's not the last one?
Oh, yeah, I think he's definitely right. The state's water plan contemplates lots of movement of water throughout the state. And I think there's probably three things that we need to keep in mind here and everywhere in Texas. One is conservation. The role of conservation is changing and changing quickly. For a long time, utilities thought conservation was low-flow toilet programs or grass rebate programs or those kinds of things. The state has now actually institutionalized the financing of conservation through these state funds. And so what it's time for us to do now is to institutionalize the implementation of conservation. And I think that means we have to think of conservation not just as a program, but as a suite of activities that surround water supply projects. It could be anything from source water protection. When you're going to get water out of someone's backyard, you should be thinking about source water protection there, just like we've protected the Edwards Aquifer here. It could be rate structures. It could be public information programs. It's that suite of activities. So redefining conservation to institutionalize it, I think, is important. The second thing is recognizing that we're really not asking the question as a state who gets water and who doesn't. Ultimately, water has four big users: growing cities, agriculture — we're still a big ag state — we've got the environment, and we've got energy and industry. And we're not going to say no categorically to any of those interests, or we should not say no. So we're really talking about optimizing. And I think avoiding some of the conflicts of my water, your water, their water is going to be really important, which gets me to the third point, which is I think probably the most important thing we can keep after in Texas is civil discourse. Water has a way of bringing out the worst in everyone, and I think our ability to have tough conversations about something that is so vital to life is really important. I think that's important in San Antonio right now as tough questions are being asked and answered.
Well, thank you. Robert Puente, SAWS every few years updates its long-term water management plan. I think the last update was 2012. I imagine there's another one coming soon. But we're also awaiting the outcome of the Texas A&M University peer review of the report that was generated at City Council and that was recommended by or requested by Councilman Nirenberg. And we'll talk about that today. But all that's going to happen between now and November 19th. You're a busy man. How does SAWS position itself now in advance of the request for the rate increase November 19th and awaiting that report?
Well, first of all, let me congratulate Mike Belden. It's an honor to lose to someone like him on that thing. What we're going through right now is a lot of outreach into the community, five public hearings throughout the neighborhoods, letting the public know what our needs are and what this rate adjustment is about. The key to this is that, as Mayor Taylor said when she gave her statement, it's not just about the Vista Ridge project. We have other needs. Our desal plant is under construction right now, but we need operating expenses for it. We are first in the state to undergo a consent decree with the federal government on sewer system upgrades, and that's over $1 billion over the next 10 years. And so this is information that we're trying to get out into the public. And just as important, water conservation, which is always at the heart of what we do at SAWS, we are changing the way we charge for water, not the rates themselves, but the structure change. And that's a conservation tool that we also have. We're going from 4 tiers to 8 tiers, and some of the middle tiers are meant to put out a price signal to individuals that if you're using this much water, watch out because it's going to get more expensive at this level. And so that'll send a trigger to you that, yes, that's fine with you, and you will still use that amount of water or more, or no, that's not okay with you, and then you start conserving. So if you start using more, revenue comes into the system. If you use less, then you're using less water. So all of these together are a rate adjustment asking for not only the Vista Ridge project, but also other needs that we have, but a rate structure change. The key to it is two things, water conservation, as I mentioned, and a lifeline rate to where if you use 3,000 gallons or less, even with a rate increase, your rates will go down. So that's key to water conservation and key to addressing the needs of a great part of our city that has financial limitations on what they can pay for this necessity.
Well, thank you. And Councilman Nirenberg, you have said that you have not made up your mind how you'll vote November 19th pending that final report. But for people here that are maybe not completely familiar with SA Tomorrow or your role in the long-term planning, would you take a few minutes to talk about why you commissioned that report, what you were hoping to accomplish with that, and make your own general remarks?
Sure. Well, and thank you also for Mike for putting on the forum. Always very well attended and very substantive, so I appreciate that. Look, we know that water is the issue. Water is the issue for our economy. The water is the issue for quality of life. We also know that 2015 will mark the end of the UN's water decade, and we still, as a globe, have water scarcity as the issue no matter where you are. 50% of the world's population lives in a state of scarcity, whether it's physical or it's economic. We know here in San Antonio, one of the reasons why it was settled here was that we had plentiful water. How we deal with that amid increasing drought, amid a population growth that's going to be, over 1 million in the next 25 years, possibly double within 35 years, is the challenge for all of our resources, all of our infrastructure, and all of our ability to manage and benefit from that growth. So the comprehensive plan, which is dubbed SA Tomorrow, is an integration of all those efforts, whether it's resource allocation or it's policy formation, really taking an assessment of what we do as a city, what we do as a private sector, to align our efforts to make sure that we accommodate that growth. With regard to the water study, which actually predates SA Tomorrow, my concern, again, was that water is the issue. It's been a limiting factor for many communities, and if we don't address the issue, if we don't answer the question of whether or not San Antonio will have water for our children and our grandchildren, it will prevent us from being the great city we want it to be. SAWS has done a fantastic job over the last 15 years in being a leader on conservation. We had the EPA administrator down here, I believe it was last year, looking at the Dos Rios plant. We have one of the largest recycled water systems. We have an ASR that will now be estimated around 200,000 acre-feet capacity, which is, in a drought year, just as much water as we use an entire year. There's a lot of things to feel good about. But amid all those challenges, we have a lot of serious questions to ask ourselves about how we're going to move forward. We heard that just this morning, great presentation by Dr. Andrews at Overland about the difference between the energy conversation and the water conservation conversation. Water is a finite resource. There's the same amount here that there was when the world was first formed. So we have to be careful with that. It requires us to do our due diligence. It requires us to answer questions about impact regionally. And it also requires us to consider policies that may be part of the shortcoming of answering that question, such as the fact that for the history of Texas, groundwater has been considered, as Dr. Sansom said, private property. In the 21st century, it's hard to understand why that makes any sense anymore. So there's a lot of questions that need to be answered locally that we need information and facts on the table before we move forward with big decisions like this, and the water study is intended to answer those questions. I know there's been a lot of pushback about that study. I regret that pushback has been construed to mean things like we are anti-SAWS or we are pro-SAWS or you have to take one side or another. All these issues that we are trying to address deserve the highest scrutiny for us to get them right. I think you're going to hear that across the board today. But I look forward to making those decisions with the right information on the table, and I think you'll see that in the coming months and years.
Well, let's stay on the report for just a minute, because aren't you asking the same questions that SAWS itself asks and asks all the time? And I'm wondering, what will that report show, or what questions will it answer that SAWS isn't indeed exploring with its own comprehensive plan?
Well, first, I mean, I would still like to see the 2015 water management plan. We haven't had that yet. So we do need some, water as an underpinning of our economic and quality of life discussions to really be illustrated with what we do at the SA Tomorrow comprehensive plan. Beyond that, we do know that everything we do in water, and we have a very long history of that here in San Antonio, lives and dies through political votes. We need to make sure that we are smart on water, that the policymakers have the right information to be consistent with our efforts on water security, and that's really what the comprehensive plan, comprehensive study is intended to do. It's not a scientific survey of how deep our aquifer wells are. It's not a survey about the scientific data available in our groundwater management areas. It is simply a survey of all the policies and jurisdictions and risks associated with managing water in the city of San Antonio and in our region. I can't think of a more important issue for us to delve into those concerns than in water. These are financial concerns, these are political concerns, these are really policy-making concerns that if we want to have a smart San Antonio, if we want to build a great city, as we say we do, we need to be armed with that information as a community and dissecting it and scrutinizing it every chance we get.
Are you still confident that by November 19th we'll have such a report that will instill confidence in voters and give elected office holders the tool that they were hoping for or that you were hoping for?
I think I am. Number one, Texas A&M was selected unanimously in a contract by City Council last year has been cited as the preeminent authority in this area on water policy research. My conversations with Texas A&M have led me to believe that we're going to get a water study that doesn't deviate too much from what was already existing. And that we expect to have it possibly by the end of October. Really, though, this is not going to get any easier. We know that. In fact, the issues are going to get more pronounced. The decisions are going to be more difficult. The scarcity and the political battles that will be waged will undoubtedly get more intense. See Representative Doug Miller out there. He can tell you about that. But we will be able to identify what questions there are that we should be asking ourselves, both internally as a community in terms of what values we share, what values we should pronounce, but also strategically how we should behave with those values.
Robert, you've been strongly critical of the report. I've taken a very different, I think, view of it than Councilman Nirenberg. How do you view it now and through this process?
It's not so much different from what Ron just said. All the things he said without the specifics of the report, I agree with 100%. Now, there's some specific things in the report that I do disagree with, and that was made public. And these are, in my opinion, just some factual errors, some assumptions that are just basically not true, using information that is dated or is just incomplete. So that was my issues with it. Now, but it will be a report, and the key to that report, I think, is one thing that got lost in the conversation about when this report was released and when it should have been released, and that is that Calvin Finch makes the point that a project of at least 50,000 acre feet is still needed for this community, for this for our continued growth to meet the supply gaps that we will see in the future. We still need that amount of water. And so some of the underlying details of that report are what I took issue to. But the overall take from this report, I think, still needs to be that this community is growing at a very fast rate, and if we're going to meet the needs of this community, We need a very large water project such as Vista Ridge.
And leaving the report aside for just a minute, and assuming that, in fact, you get a majority or even a unanimous vote on November 19th, and Vista Ridge moves forward, as well as the new rate structure, the rate increase, the money that you need to meet the EPA mandate for sewage line replacement, to help fund the desal plant that comes online next year. What will you say to the community about SAW's conservation policies going forward? Will they change at all? Do you have everything in place that that is going to be in place, or do you see new conservation initiatives coming forward?
Well, it'll change, and it'll change to continue to drive the numbers down, the per capita use numbers down. What you have to look at is SAW's history and my personal history. If you look at SAW's over the last 25 years, our per capita use has dropped by 40%. And that's why we get comments like from Texas Water Development Board on what a great job we're doing and what other cities should do, and so I appreciate that. And so SAWS has been doing this for a long time, and it's very important. And if you look, if we hadn't conserved the way we did, and this is for all the financial people out there, the business people out there, if we had not conserved the way we did, we would have had three different Vista Ridge projects to be online today to meet that growth that we currently have, that we already have. Not future growth, but current growth. Three Vista Ridge projects. Not only that, we would have had to have another wastewater treatment plant. Instead of that, we actually closed one down. We used to have four wastewater treatment plants. We closed one down, saved all kinds of O&M costs, all kinds of costs of having to upgrade that plant to make sure it met current standards. So water conservation, whether you think Sierra Club, environmental, sustainability, green issue, fine. It's very important for all those purposes. It's just as important if you're Wall Street, if you're a CFO, that it's a great tool for the bottom line. So water conservation has been a tenet of mine and of SAWS throughout SAWS's creation and throughout my political career. In the 1990s, when it was very unpopular to do water conservation measures, I passed a great share of water conservation bills that SAWS currently is taking advantage of, not just SAWS, but the entire state of Texas. So all those arguments about conservation going on the wayside or us not stepping it up on water conservation is just incorrect. We are driving the numbers down. We want to still be the leaders in water conservation on the residential side and the commercial side.
Andy or Laura, do either of you, as people in the conservation business outside of San Antonio, see more things we could be doing here?
Well, I think San Antonio does a great job. I mean, San Antonio is recognized nationally for doing a great job. I think just to tease this apart a little bit, yeah, I think more is going to happen in the future is the short answer, and that was just acknowledged. But you've got supply side and demand side conservation efforts, and I think we tend to think of one or the other. So here's what's happening in San Antonio. On the demand side, most of those interventions are designed to drop the curve so that we're using fewer gallons per capita. And that's to stretch existing water supplies as far into the future as we can, and I think San Antonio is clearly a leader on that. The supply side is also interesting to me because the Edwards Aquifer Protection Program is considered a global best practice. If you add up not just what San Antonio has done, but what the counties have done and what Austin has done, our citizens have invested nearly $1 billion in protecting that aquifer, and that's source water protection. That is conserving the quality of water in the aquifer, which is absolutely an affordability strategy because treating water is expensive. When you think about pulling water supplies out of basins outside of your own basin, I think one place that we need to be exploring is what source water protection programs do we need to be thinking of in those new places where we're getting supply. And I think that's an area where we can stretch our thinking. And then, of course, you talked about it, but stormwater is also a way to practice conservation. I think it is fabulous that Mayor Ivey was talking about bioswales. Mayors all over the country are talking about not just pipeline replacement for capturing stormwater, but using natural infrastructure. And that can also be a part of this mosaic of conservation. So the point that I would like to make is it is a much more robust way of thinking about how we can conserve water. This can no longer be just a division within a utility. It has to be the way we think about our CIP programs.
Well, if the new drought of record was the drought that we just survived, are we reaching the point in Texas where we'll have the conversation that's already occurred in Las Vegas and Nevada? It's now happening in California under Governor Brown, which is where we use financial incentives to get people to eliminate automatic irrigation systems and remove non-native landscaping. That seems to me to be, if you talk about a very large percentage of water use in San Antonio, where could we get water that is not essential to life or commerce? It would be residential lawn irrigation. Are we getting there in Texas where that can be discussed?
We're already there at Solace. We are already doing that. We are already paying our customers a rebate program to take out portions of the irrigation systems and put in hardscape, put in other types of plant that don't use as much water. So we're doing it already at Solace. We're paying customers.
You have a program, but let's be candid. San Antonio is not getting off non-native turf or irrigation systems. They're built into every new gated community and subdivision in the city, and those users out there are not using your program en masse. The program is almost like a pilot project in terms of its size or its impact on overall water usage. Las Vegas, there's no water systems left. They've just about virtually eliminated them because people have bought onto it en masse. So that's the difference between here and there that I'm talking about.
It can be scaled bigger, obviously, and we would need help from the development community, help from the home builders community, help from city council if we're going to get to a big level like that that does reach the stage or the comments that you're making.
Can I add one other thing, Bob, is we just got off the water study, but I want to focus on this for a second because demand management is really what this is about. And the water study does provide policy recommendations on things like memorializing our conservation, on landscaping, on lid development, on things approaching even preventing contaminants going into the aquifer. I think what Laura said is extremely important, and that is the Edwards Aquifer Protection Program is a supply strategy. It's not just for keeping green spaces, which is great too, but it's to ensure that we have water available for our future. And this document, the reason why we need a comprehensive plan and the reason why water is part of our SA Tomorrow plan is because all of these are integrated within city policy. And so I think it's an extremely important conversation to have with regard to supply.
Well, as an elected official, would you advocate for a more aggressive, a more robust, a better funded program to eliminate non-native landscaping?
I already have. In fact, my office since, really when I first started, has been advocating for a series of initiatives. We pushed for the Edwards Aquifer Protection Program to be renewed. We have asked for PAH study so that we can look at, just like other communities around San Antonio are doing, banning coal tar sealants from getting into our recharge area. We also have been advocating for lid development in our recharge area and also in throughout the city of San Antonio. So all of these things are doable. They're doable through city council. They need to be part of city code and city development policy.
Yeah, how do you think your constituents in District 8 are responding to the opportunity to remove their automatic irrigation systems and replace non-native landscaping?
I've gotten hundreds of phone calls. Well, maybe not hundreds. Hundreds if you count emails as well. I've had three people that are deeply concerned with conservation. In fact, I know that SAWS has been doing their own survey, and it's similar results. People want this to happen, and that is because they realize water is getting more expensive. They realize it's finite, and they want to make sure that their city authority, that their policymakers are doing everything they can to get the cheap stuff done right first, to protect the aquifer, to make sure that we are protecting the cheaper supplies to drive down costs going forward. And, as we know, the dire situation for San Antonio would be if one day we woke up and we needed to somehow filter or treat Edwards Aquifer water. That would be the worst-case scenario for us, and we've been doing everything we can, my office and the entire council, to make sure that doesn't happen.
Andy, we know that we're going to enter another drought cycle at some point sooner than later. Do you think the political culture in the state is changing to where some of these more aggressive conservation measures are possibly going to occur?
Well, it's interesting that our legislature, as has been noted here today, and Robert, by the way, was one of the foremost supporters of our work when I was in the government, but our legislature tends to act and do really hard things only in two circumstances, one in which we have a crisis like we did in 2011, or two, whether we're under a federal court order. And so I think that one of the problems with this issue is that we our horizon is not anywhere near long enough to really address the issues of the future. You mentioned Las Vegas and California. This is a global issue. It reaches much farther than the United States. Every 20 seconds across the world, someone dies because of lack of water or poor water quality. So we need to look beyond the borders of our own country to places like Israel and Western Australia, where water consumption per capita is dramatically lower. Now, those places also diversify their supply. And so you can't ever lead yourself to believe that reducing demand is going to solve the problem. But it needs to be part of the transaction when these big projects are contemplated so that it is embedded in the deal.
Do you see desalination as a potential tool for doing that? You mentioned Israel. I think it's called the Carlsbad plant in San Diego is about to come online after about 15 years of planning. That's going to be ocean water desalination as well. We have our brackish water desalination phase one, Robert, coming in online, I believe, at the end of next year. But how much is desal going to be a part of that mix of using water that's not Edwards water?
It has to be. And I think, once again, this community is wise to address brackish desal first, because we are not ready to pay what it's going to cost to desalinate water from the Gulf of Mexico and then pump it 150 miles upstream. We're simply not, as a society, prepared to pay those costs yet. So brackish desal becomes a wonderful intermediate step toward desalination.
Robert, do you have any updates on that program? Is it still on track to be started by the end of 2016?
Yes. If you go out there, and encourage anybody to take a little trip to Southern Bexar County, Andy is correct. Why go to the Gulf Coast when you have tons and tons of acre feet of water right here under your feet, right here in Bexar County, of brackish water, not as salty, therefore not as expensive to treat, and obviously not as expensive to transport all the way over here. But overall, ocean desal, yes, that's an answer for some communities. Bill West and GBRA are probably the closest to it. And for example, in Brownsville, we have a new engineer, vice president of engineering from Brownsville. They have a desal plant, but it's groundwater. It is not ocean water. In Brownsville, that's right. The Gulf Coast is right there. So yes, our plant is online. October of 2016, it'll start delivering drinking water to San Antonio.
Let's change the topic a little bit back to growth. You mentioned 1 million people are coming by 2040, 2050, whatever the projections are. Some opponents of Vista Ridge are most concerned that that volume of water, Robert, is going to require you to go out and find new customers, and that that's going to generate more sprawl, more suburban development, and specifically development west of Texas 281 into the Hill Country.
Well, it is a project of 50,000 acre feet, and at the very beginning of our planning, we show that we don't need all of that 50,000 acre feet. But it is not cost effective to just buy a smaller amount of water, because the pipeline has to be the same size. So we commissioned 50,000 acre feet of water. That's what's coming in 2020. And so we have some options. One of them is to sell some of that water along the I-30 corridor from here to the source county of Bertelsen. There's a lot of growth there, probably the fastest growing part of the United States. So there's opportunities there. If for whatever reason, cities, utilities, entities do not wish to buy some of that water, we can still bring it all the way to San Antonio. And if we're not using it all, we can store it. Not necessarily the Vista Ridge water, but Edwards water. So we will be able to really store some water and invariably get ready for those drought conditions. So San Antonio is growing. I have a commitment. My board has a commitment to make sure that we don't just take care of this morning when you wanted to take a shower and you wanted to flush your toilets. We have a commitment for far out into the future. This group of central young men over here, I don't want them to have to go out of state to go find a wife. We need to be able to supply that growth here.
So you have 1.6 million ratepayers. I'm not sure what state we'd go to, but you have 1.6 million ratepayers, which is larger than the population of San Antonio because you serve areas that aren't in the city of San Antonio. Some of those areas we're talking about now for a limited annexation program. But what would SAW's policy be going forward about where it will extend service and where it won't extend service? How do you make that decision and in terms of how it relates to development where development now doesn't exist, whether it's over the recharge zone or elsewhere?
Well, right now we have boundaries, a certificate of convenience and necessity, essentially our boundary lines, and that's what we have served. That's what we're obligated to serve under state law. And so we will look to the city. If the city is growing east, west, north, or south, we will grow in that manner. And whatever city policies they have in place, we will be there to supplement them. For example, a part of the city's growth was to try to redirect some of that growth into the south side of San Antonio. So we are building a huge sewer line in southwest San Antonio, big enough to support a city the size of Corpus Christi to help that that sewer growth. And this was a private-public partnership to help implement those city programs. So if the city wants to have us grow because they're annexing or they're wishing to go in a certain direction, SAWS will be right there. But we take our direction from the city council as far as those growth issues are concerned.
Councilman, do you see the SA Tomorrow initiative as something to just measure and anticipate that million people and where they're going to be in that kind of growth, or do you see it as a tool to manage that growth? And if so, how would you manage to reduce sprawl or slow sprawl and drive greater residential density in the existing city now, as Mr. Puente just pointed out?
Well, I think the mayor has made it very clear this is not a measurement tool. I mean, this is a plan for us to formulate policy and manage resources, financial resources of the city, our personnel resources, and also where we hope to drive growth. I agree with those folks who say we can't stop growth, but we can manage it. We can formulate a strategy of policies that will help direct incentives, will help direct policies related to development that encourage the growth inward. And that's really what cuts to the core of the water conversation is demand management. One strategy is to make sure that we densify the urban core. Not everyone has to live in the urban core, but at least we should give people the choice to do so. We know that when we do that, we have less demand on irrigation of residential areas. We also know that it's less demanding on our transportation dollar. There's all reasons in the world for us to really focus on reducing the sprawl. So we are focusing on that with the SA Tomorrow Comprehensive Plan. And it's going to require us, though, that when we make big decisions, whether it's a water issue or it's a transportation issue or it's an education issue, that we have all the facts on the table and that we're aligned. Because what's difficult about this whole situation and why I think people are nervous and are on a hairline trigger is that it's a political process. We need to make sure that council and our public, our constituents, are armed with the right information. So when we make a tough decision related to the UDC, perhaps, that we are clear about our rationale, that we understand the reason for it publicly, and that we also have the political will to get it done. If we don't follow through on some of these decisions and we go ahead and pull the trigger on, say, annexation or something else, we could really be doing the opposite of what we want to accomplish with managing resources.
Chairman Bruin, you see all the water projects that are underway in the state. Are the smaller communities that are between Austin and San Antonio all along the I-35 corridor, which are growing so rapidly, are they prepared for their water needs 50 years from now?
I'd say yes, because there's a plan and planning process there for them to take advantage of, which to a large extent they have. I do think that 2011 was a bit of a wake-up call if we needed one. But you know, the state water plan projects, again, that these folks are moving to Texas at a rapid clip. I mean, the fact that we're here talking about the best way to manage growth, we're still talking about significant growth. And I'm sure there's other places in the state, and especially outside of Texas, that would love to be having that conversation and debate about how they're going to manage that. But it is going to take continued active planning. It's going to take our board and agency being engaged as a leader in that. and continuing to promote the different financing programs that we have available so that when these entities are ready to move forward with those projects, that they have cost-effective ways to be able to do so that ultimately passes some savings on to their ratepayers.
Robert, none of those communities yet have stepped forward and said they want to purchase some of that Vista Ridge water that will be coming, I guess, in 2019 or 2020 when the pipeline's completed. Are you surprised by that, or do you think we're still too far away from water delivery for people to take the project seriously and believe it will really happen?
No, I'm not surprised that they haven't said yes. They are looking for the actual price. The price has not been set. We do have a ceiling in the contract we negotiated with Abengoa. We have a ceiling on what it can be. And so they're looking at as to what the actual price is going to be. So come financial close for Vista Ridge, for Abengoa, and probably happen in the second quarter of next year, then we will have a set price. Then we will know that the project is funded because they will be hopefully a rate support for it to come this November and financial close. And so the communities we've been talking to, then we will be able to talk to them in much more detail. This is what it costs. This is what we can afford to potentially sell and for what period of time. Now, there's some communities that are going to want this water for as long as we want the water. There's other communities that may need this as a bridge just to get from this project that they have to another project that they're also planning. And this is all part of the statewide water plan. And so there's going to be some opportunities there. What we have told council is that the rates that we're asking for is a worst-case scenario. It's as if we cannot sell any of that water. And so we could potentially have much lower rate increases if we can sell some of that water.
Andy, do you think communities are as prepared as the chairman thinks they are, or do you think they'll be lining up someday to try to buy Vista Ridge water?
Well, I think that the urgent need for water is particularly intense between here and Austin. And I think that you're seeing struggles between competing projects, between source water and consumers all up and down the corridor. I'd like to go back and address something that the councilman dealt with, which was the issue of sprawl. For me, it's not just an issue of reduction of sprawl. It's also an issue of mitigation. And I point out here today that this community, Travis County, where I live, and Hays County, where I work, have spent more money protecting the watersheds and recharge areas west of us than the entire state and federal government combined over the last 20 years. And so continuing to find ways to mitigate this growth that we all appreciate and we all know is coming is an important part of this transaction.
And in San Antonio, you're talking about Proposition 1, where voters approved for the fourth time over 20 years or 15 years now funding to go out and buy development rights over sensitive parts of the recharge zone.
Throughout the United States, bond issues for that purpose are overwhelmingly approved. We're from New York to California, and they're always based on water, even though the outcome is land protection.
Do you want to say something on that?
Well, look, I said it before. It's this region has invested in a way that no other place on the planet has. It's because people understand the importance of water. It's because San Antonio probably has one of the highest water IQs in the country. It's one of the few places you can use the word aquifer, and everybody knows what it is. And it's because every aspect of this community is in constant discussion about water, including the media. You can't watch the news at night without, you know, knowing what the aquifer levels are. So I think it's a remarkable program. It is part of an affordability strategy, and we haven't talked a lot about that today, but all growing Texas cities are worried about affordability. And the one way to keep, you know, one of the highest bills people pay is their utility bill. A great way to make your utility bill spike is to have your groundwater so polluted you have to treat it like surface water. So every penny that's been spent protecting the Edwards Aquifer is a water-saving strategy for this community. I think it's really, really important that San Antonio has led in this way. And I think source water protection, as cities go beyond their basins, we're going to have to look at. Because if you've got a new basin that is your source water, what are we going to do to protect that? And I think as we transfer water around the state, making sure that we don't leave places worse than we found them is going to be important.
How do we do that when we can't even agree on models to measure underground water? And in fact, we don't seem to really know how much water is down there, whether it's our own aquifer, the Edwards, or whether we talk about Burleson and Lee. We have competing models that have been used to for people both for and against the Vista Ridge project to talk about what impact, if any, we will have on that pipeline will have on Burleson and Lee counties in terms of their underground water. How do people make a sensible, logical decision about whether they're for or against that when we can't measure it yet?
Well, you have to invest more in science. I think probably today the bulk of the investigation of groundwater across the state, which we do not understand fully, is paid for by philanthropy. And that's really unacceptable. We need to be spending more public dollars understanding the nature of our aquifers and the extent of water which we may get from them.
And would that be the Texas Water Board that would do that if you had the funding?
Well, we do actively engage in that type of science and research. We work on what's what are referred to as groundwater availability models that are used for groundwater management across the state by groundwater conservation districts. It's a hugely important part of what we do, but we are not regulatory. So at the end of the day, those decisions as to whether or not a permit's going to be issued for a certain amount of water to be pumped and transported will be made at the local level. And that ultimately, if that's going to change, that would be directed by our legislature.
And Bob, I would say this, we'll have science that disagrees with itself whenever it comes to these water issues. And I think the only way that I've ever known how to reconcile building a contract around an uncertain future is building in the ability to take a second look if you're not right about that. And so if the estimates are wrong in any direction, then the aquifer has to have the ability to do curtailments or something like that. The science is never going to tell us within, three decimal points exactly how much water is there, and I think we have to recognize that and create contractual provisions so that if we're wrong, we can take a second look.
And does the contract, the Vista Ridge contract, Robert, have those provisions in it elements in Burleson and Lee County decided that the impact on the aquifer was different than the one that was modeled?
Yes, and that's one of the keys of this contract is that we leave local control of the aquifer where it is in the Post-Oak Savannah District. That's Burleson and Milam counties. So if whatever reason they feel that because of our project or any other project there, whether it's farming or another exportation of water, that the drawdown is too much for them to take, they can cut back and there will be less water coming to San Antonio. Therefore, we don't have to pay for that infrastructure. We don't have to pay for that that pipeline. Those decisions will be kept in Burleson County. It's part of the contract.
What would be your plan B if something like that did happen? People refer all the time to Abengoa's credit rating, which is a very different credit rating than the one SAWS has. And, of course, you're not paying for that pipeline construction directly. But how do you reconcile their credit rating at Abengoa's, the possibility of there being a risk that the pipeline never gets built or that the water can't be delivered over that 30 to 60-year period? What happens then?
As far as their financial situation, we knew this when we were negotiating with them. And so one of the things we negotiated was a lot of protections for us. For example, if they can't come with financing, if come financial close, they don't get Wall Street, they don't get banks to fund that project, then they owe us $2 million. So we have protections in there. Now, what that essentially means is that there are still some permits out there because Abengoa does not own the water. Blue Water, another entity that's in conjunction with Abengoa, they have the lease rights. So we can negotiate with them to actually build that pipeline. That's one option that we have. Another option is to find another type of Abengoa company that will build the pipeline. But we can also on our own do a different type of plan B, and that's to more fully scale out our brackish plant in southern Bexar County. Brackish plants are very easily expandable. We have already designed it to be twice its size, so it's very easily expandable. There's a lot of water here in Texas, in this area, as far as brackish water, the Wilcox aquifer not being used by anyone. Texas Water Development Board will tell you that their statistics show that it's a truly untapped source of water. So plan B is very doable, and it's very easily and quickly able to be done.
On City Council, is there concern about Abengoa, Councilman, or do you feel confident that the contract protects the city and SAWS and is not an issue?
Well, so long as Abengoa remains in the picture, I think Robert is absolutely right. I mean, the financial risk has been allayed from that contract. The concern, though, has been the health of the company. And really, you know, when it comes to completing a contract, there's a couple issues. One is, will the water be there? And I think that's why you're seeing additional scrutiny on the models. The Region L plan, the draft plan, supports some of the things that have been said about the available groundwater. But you're absolutely right about the state water plan has really no teeth, regulatory teeth. So when it says that a Vista Ridge project or a Four Star project both exceed the maximum available groundwater in those areas, there's really there's nothing there to prevent those contracts from being carried out because, again, the groundwater conservation districts can permit and can sell the water as they see fit. But with regard to the health of Abengoa and the completion of the contract, I hear two things. One is that the risk is allayed onto the company, which is very important that they stay in the picture and they construct the project. Now, I'm also hearing, though, that it's very easy for us to purchase and build the pipeline ourselves, in which case the risk now defers strictly onto the San Antonio ratepayer. So we really need to figure out what is our logic, what is our strategy moving forward under different scenarios. Because I went to National Night Out, for instance, earlier this month, and every single house, every single block party was asking about water and was thankful that we were asking these questions and making due diligence. Half of them were very much in favor of what we're doing with the project and everything we talked about, the need for regional sourcing of water. But they want us to make sure they do that we do our due diligence and answer these questions and establish our rationale and be public about it, which is exactly what this debate is about. When we launched the study, when we initiated the study, it was to elevate the conversation about water. That's exactly what's being taken. That's taking place right now. What we don't want to do is accelerate into the fog. We want to identify what the issues are and address them.
So there is a possibility that if something were to occur that Abengoa couldn't comply, couldn't keep its part of the contract, that the City of San Antonio and SAWS could undertake the project independently?
I mean, that's what I've heard several times from SAWS, and it would be cheaper if we did that. But the reason why we are working with a private company to do this is that it allays that risk. So we have to be clear on the fact that we need to allay the risk, and we need to make sure that the company that we're allaying the risk to is healthy, can complete the project. And these are questions that any business owner, anyone who's spending a reasonable amount of money investing in a company would ask. And I'm expected to ask. That's my job to ask. And we will continue to ask those questions for the life of the project. And I think that that comes at no surprise to Robert, because I sent him a letter about it last year in July saying, I'm going to ask you about these questions as we move along. And, you know, as some things have been said about the company and other press reports, we have asked more questions. But I think that council deserves answers and constituents deserve answers. If they are satisfactory answers, we will continue to move forward with the project.
Chairman Bruin, would you loan us the money? Would you finance that project?
If SAWS is applying for it, sure.
All right.
Because of their credit rating?
They have been a good customer. Most of our programs are designed for the applicant to be a political subdivision, so we have great experience with SAWS, and if they were to come apply for money for that project, I'm sure that would be viewed favorably.
And I think you've used the number of, over the years, we've borrowed $800 million from Texas Water Development Board?
That's right.
Robert, why are you not concerned about their credit rating and the company's stability?
Well, because the concerns were addressed by us and by them a year ago when we were negotiating this contract. We did our due diligence. We investigated the circumstances. We had our financial advisors in the negotiating room. They had their financial advisors in the negotiating room. We understood what was going on. Additionally, there's not a lender that's going to lend this Vista Ridge Abengoa $800 million to build this pipeline without them being assured that their money is safe. So they're going to look at their financial condition, but what they're truly going to look at is the contract itself, and the contract says that SAWS's credit rating, our ability to have the rates to pay for this project, is what is going to pay for that project. So their credit rating is not as important as our own ability to pay the bill as it comes due. And our ability to pay the bill when it becomes due is dependent on City Council this coming November. So that's going to be key. Obviously, we need rates to support this big of a project. So come financial close, we feel that everything will come together as far as the lenders doing their due diligence on Abengoa themselves. As I mentioned, they're not going to put out that money without some assurances, and we've also done our due diligence in protecting SAWS.
You know, we're all calling it a rate increase in November for shorthand, but in fact, doesn't the new eight-tiered system reward both conservation and also protect working-class families so that people that are low-water users will pay less over the ensuing years than they would have otherwise paid with the existing rate system?
Every 5 years, we change the way we ask council to help us and our board to help us how we charge for water, not the rates, but how do we charge. And this year, going in, we had essentially three goals. One of them is to make sure that everything is fair, that business pays for business, residential pays for residential. But other ones were water conservation and knowing that a project like Vista Ridge was coming online, to make sure that the least of us can afford that kind of water, that necessity. So I think we succeeded. What we're asking for of council, our board will approve this hopefully in the coming, they've approved this already, is that a certain amount of water, 3,000 gallons per month, helps those individuals that continuously throughout their years have used less and less water. So you can be a very wealthy couple and you live in a townhome, but you have bought into the conservation method and you like that, and so you're using less and less water, you'll get rewarded. But if you're of low means, if you use that little bit of water, your rates will actually go down. They will go down, even with this rate increase. So I think we've been very successful, and I mentioned the price signals that are sent in the middle tiers out to those individuals that, hey, you're using a lot of water, it might be time for you to come down a bit into another tier, the lower tier, where the water is cheaper.
And I just wanted to add that, you know, it's unfortunate that asking questions like this is sometimes viewed as an adversarial action. What we want to do is ensure that SAWS is successful. There's a great track record there. As Laura said, San Antonio and the region are doing some amazing things on water. We have been for a while. We've been investing in ourselves. Mike said that we're all in this together. It truly is that way. And so these questions we ask on behalf of our constituents. They demand answers. They aren't happy that their bills are going up, but we have to explain why. And so we take that job very seriously. So in asking these questions and doing our due diligence and getting the information and the facts on the table before we are made to make a decision, it's to help us work with SAWS to make sure that they're successful. They have been a shining star for San Antonio. We want to make sure that that remains the case.
Are you comfortable with the new rate structures, and do you think most of your constituents realize that they reward conservation in the case of people that limit their water use to a certain per capita basis, that they'll actually see their bills go down?
Yeah, I've been very encouraged by the rate structure. I have a few questions that we've been talking about offline with regard to wholesale rates and commercial rates, but by and large, this is a fantastic step forward for San Antonio in integrating those price signaling measures that we've been talking about for a while. The fact that the Rate Advisory Committee got a unanimous vote and worked well together is also a signal to the rest of us that we have to make tough decisions on rates. But, you know, we need to continue to push on conservation. Again, that's what our constituents, our residents across San Antonio will be expecting us to do the basics first. And until we do that, and until we can assure that through the information that we provide, we're not going to have a very satisfied resident base. So we just want to make sure that we're continuing to do that due diligence.
Okay, I'm not sure where Scott Storman is, but do we have an extra microphone that we can take out into the audience and give people the opportunity to join the conversation? It's dark out there. I can't see if he's... Here he comes now. Well, we'll invite everybody that is interested in just raising your hand, and we'll bring the microphone over, and you can identify yourself and ask a question. Got a hand up over here, Scott.
I want to go... Is it on? Yes. I want to go back to something that Robert Puente said earlier about a program at SAWS that credits customers for replacing plants with hardscape. And I want to raise the issue of the energy nexus and hardscape and whether or not we may be doing something that is counterproductive. And I have no objection to replacing with local water-saving plants or even well-adaptive natives. But I do think that CPS Energy, we know, gives a credit based on a HARC study in Houston for planting trees that shade your home. And that's because it does save energy to shade the house. If we were to be successful in replacing an extraordinary percentage of our landscape with hardscape, I think we may raise our power bills and increase our water usage for power. So my question is, can we initiate an analysis to actually measure that? And I had a guest who likes to run the neighborhood at 5:30 in the morning. I don't do that. But running in the neighborhood was cool. Switching to taking a route out on Nacogdoches and Broadway suddenly was 10 degrees hotter at 5:30 in the morning. So I'm thinking, to do good water planning, it's not just big projects. It's a lot of messy little things, and if we're willing to do them, the combination may be very satisfactory.
So I think the question was, should we add trees to your landscape rebate program?
I think it is better to look at the programs dealing with impervious cover as they relate to overall development, parking lots, rooftops. What we're talking about is more of a piecemeal hardscape like a deck. Water filters through the deck. There's little cracks in it, falls onto the ground. So the magnitude that you're talking about, Carol, I think is very different. But if it gets to the point where we need to do an analysis, yes, we would.
Where's our questioner? Okay, go ahead.
My question's related to urban sprawl. Several of you panelists have talked about that, and the city continues to grow outside the city limits. We've all talked about the jurisdiction of the city and controlling lots of things. I would suggest that we're really missing a tremendous element in that control of urban sprawl and directing things back towards the inner city, and that's the ability for the counties to have ordinance-making power. And we've the legislature, and I say this to Doug and to those of you that are in the legislature or to any legislator, that counties should be given ordinance-making power that they can impose some of those restrictions and sensible things out in the rural areas in the county that are not controlled by cities would do a great deal towards stopping urban sprawl. The legislature has been reluctant to do that because there are some very strong interest groups that have fought that and are very influential in the legislature. I think we really need to move strongly towards trying to seek some relief at the legislative level on that issue.
Well, I didn't hear a question in that, but does anyone think realistically the Texas legislature is going to give counties ordinance making power?
I can't speak for the legislature, but I can tell you that that concern is at the heart of our annexation issue right now, which is the need to expand the city's boundaries in order to manage the development that occurs there. I mean, I think that you're hearing pushback from the state and county level from some folks because they believe it's a local control issue. But really, for us, it's a how do we grow our community in a sustainable way? And that's, for me, been the true north. I had conversations back in July letting the Joint Base San Antonio folks know that I can't support annexation unless we deal with the impervious cover issue as a mitigation device for the bases. So I think that's exactly true. It's going to take a lot of political will to make that happen. But if we had that on the table today, you'd see a much different conversation happening about annexation.
And I would say there's the other side of that coin is whether or not San Antonio will accept density. Because controlling sprawl is one thing, but the other thing is the way to densify a city is to densify neighborhoods. And often that's something that people are in favor of conceptually until there's a zoning case in their neighborhood. And I think, you know, if you want to prevent sprawl, then you have to accept the fact that we're going to have more people living in neighborhoods in different formats than detached single-family houses. And those can be tough issues for people that are used to those kinds of neighborhoods.
I agree with Weir and the councilman that this is at the heart of these issues, whether it's in Bexar County or Travis County or Hays or Comal. This issue of fragmentation west of us is central to this discussion. I'm familiar with a piece of property in the next tier of counties that had a pipeline built across it in 1928. And to get entirely across the county in 1928, they dealt with 12 landowners. In 2013, the pipeline was removed, taken down to the Eagle Ford, and repurposed, and they dealt with 2,000 landowners. Texas loses rural and agricultural land faster than any other state. And so whenever we think of a major infrastructure project, we need to build into it mitigation to preserve those parts of the landscape that actually make the hydrologic system work.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Hello, Moses West. I hear a lot of people talk about drawing water out of the ground and using our surface water and conserving water. And all these technologies, all these things that we do are great. But on the academic side of where we get our water from, does anybody look at new technology to draw water from different sources that aren't commonly used that we talk about on a regular basis? We're talking about things right now that we've done for the past 500 years. And here we are in a new century where technological advancements for finding new sources of water are out there that we should all be looking at right now. Is there anything that the panel does or anyone else out here, Texas A&M, the university systems, the researchers, the academic field, to alleviate some of these problems that we have with drought? Because there are technologies out there and they need a good, serious review. Is there anything being done to look at these new sources of water?
You know, it's been said that the most common question asked in the water community over the last 50 years has been, you know, where do you want the concrete? We do suffer from a situation in which it's kind of it worked for us in the 50s, so it ought to work for us again. And I think bringing innovative technology into this equation is one of the most critical things we can do. But it has been very difficult simply because of the culture and institutional nature of the water community.
Well, I'll give you a great example of where technology is already available and known, and that's in agricultural efficiencies. The vast majority of water that's used all over the planet is used to grow food, and we've got the highest water losses involved with that water use. And those technologies, including modern irrigation equipment that can detect moisture levels and know when to rain or when to irrigate, not just because it's Tuesday at 10, lining channels, all that is known. The question there is really how do we create a value proposition that that either incents or requires wholesale replacement of irrigation equipment, and it's going to have to be incents versus required. So there's technology out there for the single largest block of water that's used that has the single largest block of water losses.
And there's efforts in this community to accelerate the bringing new technology into the issue. So it is being addressed, but it is a tough problem.
You know, we've got lots of great thinking happening. I heard in your question a plug for Dr. Mattson's new institute at Texas A&M San Antonio. I also heard a plug for other think tank activities that are happening, like Accelerate H2O as another organization that's formed strictly to leverage technology. We know that to meet the demands for water in the future, long-term water security is built partly on seawater desal, so we hope that technology will help drive the cost down. So I think technology is something that we continue to have to leverage and put dollars behind to make that happen.
I'd just add that things we see in here around the state where entities are talking about innovative technologies are already proven technologies here in San Antonio. When you look at what has been put in place as far as desal, brackish desalination, and reuse. We haven't really mentioned the word reuse yet. Sols is already very active with reuse here, and thanks to examples in other places around the state, such as Wichita Falls, there are other cities that are starting to look at reuse as being part of their future water supplies in a big way.
Bob, we have a question from a student from Burbank High School.
Hello, my name is Gabriel Falcone. I'm an IB student at Burbank High School. And recently, in my biology class, we've been learning about water quality. And I know that there's some ways that regular citizens could take action within their own homes and communities to help benefit water quality and conservation, such as buying phosphate-free detergents and soaps that, properly disposing of your pet waste that could enter the river from storm runoff. And that could be very contaminating to the river and water sources. And also, you can minimize the use of nitrates in your fertilizer, your lawns, and your garden. And I want to know if there are any other examples or ideas that y'all know of to address water quality within your own home.
Well, first of all, Suzanne Scott from the San Antonio River Authority is cheering you on because of what you had to say there about all of that.
I was going to ask to give the mic to Suzanne. Let her answer that question.
Suzanne?
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. And I'm so excited about these students. These water quality issues are things that we, of course, are addressing very proactively. We are working on changes to our Unified Development Code to promote low-impact development strategies and green infrastructure and those sorts of things. I think that's going to help a lot. But as far as things individuals can do, there's so many. There are the things that you mentioned. Picking up after your pets is very important. Rainwater harvesting are also something that's very important that people can do. There's all kinds of personal things that I think that you as students and you as the next generation can really help to promote those kinds of activities. And we at the River Authority would love to come and speak to your class and talk to you more about what you can do. You can become watershed-wise warriors and really help us to promote and advocate for taking care of our watersheds. And thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate that and how smart and innovative you are in your thinking. Thank you so much.
Bravo.
Hello, my name is Karen Wheeler, and my question is, who would I talk to about the resource that goes pretty much untapped, and that is rainfall? If we had saved all of the rain, I got 9 inches at my house, that before, it seems like the policy or the plan for San Antonio is get it out of here through some sort of cement object and into the river as fast as possible. If we actually kept the amount of rainfall that we had, that would be a whole nother water source. I've brought it up a couple of times to SAWS, and they've said, well, you know, we do capture rainwater because we pump it out of aquifers. I'm talking about before it gets in there. through land development practices. This is a huge amount of water that just goes right on down the river and could help people downstream of us with flooding problems. Who do I talk to? Do I talk to the Edwards Aquifer? I know that they've got like the recharge dam on the western part of the county, Seco Creek. I've brought it up a couple of times to Saws. Is it a city policy problem? Councilman Nuremberg, in the way we deal with stormwater runoff, it's just to channelize it and get it out of here as fast as possible.
I mean, I guess the way I would answer that is during the whole process of Vista Ridge and so forth, we've been talking about conservation. And as many of you know, I've advocated for memorializing what is our stage one water use. What I would love to see happen is that we figure out a way between the city and Saws for us to incentivize the use of rainwater systems and basically take our foot off the brake of those folks on the irrigation policies. If you want to irrigate your lawn every day of the week, that's great if you have rainwater to do it with. But there's ways that we can enter that discussion in a reasonable way that doesn't automatically jump to a conclusion that this needs to be a utility scale endeavor. Rainwater is a great source of water for communities that are currently using it, and I would like to see it more incentivized within San Antonio.
Bob, we have one more question from a student at Central Catholic High School.
Great. Given that another drought in our city is almost inevitable, does Saws have any plans to implement new water restrictions, or why does it ever lift water restrictions in the first place?
I'm sorry, what was the last part of that question?
Why does it lift the water restrictions in the first place?
Well, water restrictions are mandated by state law. So when the level gets, in the aquifer gets to a certain level, we have to go into stage one, two, three, four, depending on the level of that aquifer. Saws is lucky enough that we have alternate sources of water. So even though the utility is under stage one, two, or three because of that water level, we have the Trinity Aquifer, we have our recycled water system, we have our underground storage of water, we have all these other water sources we can rely on to supplement that and prevent our customers from going into deeper stages of drought. So yes, because of that state legislation and because of lack of rainfall the last few years, we have never been able to get to a point above the aquifer level where we are out of drought restrictions. We did hit it earlier this summer when we had an abundant supply of water, rainfall, in the spring and the early summer. So we were out for a little while, had to quickly go back in into stage one and two because it fell within those levels. Our goal at Saws, for example, the Vista Ridge project is a drought-proof project. Water will be available regardless of the circumstances of rainfall because there's so much water in that aquifer. So what we're looking is not only diversifying our source, but diversifying our source to make it more secure in the future where it's drought-proof.
What about the councilman's suggestion that we memorialize just staying in stage one permanently? And we were in and out of it so quickly it was almost beside the point, and it seemed to suggest that there really is no need. The community is habituated to living under the fairly moderate restrictions. Why not just by ordinance put them in place permanently?
Well, one of the things is, for example, this summertime, we were out of drought restrictions for about a month, maybe 45 days. But during that time period, our customers were able to irrigate as often as they wanted to, and our revenues went up. We were able to make up for the losses that we were experiencing during the winter time when the way we calculate our sewer bills was way down. So it's a very it affects revenues. We believe that it affects revenues. Now, I know Councilman Nuremberg has talked about it, and we're looking at it, but we haven't got to the point where we can give him information that says it's a good idea or a bad idea. We're collecting information. We do know that it affects revenue positively sometimes when you don't have restrictions, such as this summer. We do understand that once a week watering is not a conservation tool. It's a water management or a drought tool to be used. But if we have alternate sources of water, if we have abundant supplies, our customers would want to buy that. And if they want to buy it, we want to sell it.
So is there an inherent tension between being an agency of conservation and also being a revenue-generating utility?
No. As I mentioned, water conservation is actually a very good business model. It's when you do water conservation long-term and you plan for it and you have the idea that your per capita use goes down steadily throughout the years. When you use water conservation to address drought management, that's when you get a lot of trouble. That's the trouble that Fort Worth got into, Austin, Wichita Falls. They started using conservation tools to address drought management. We use drought management tools to address drought. Conservation is a way of life for salts.
Well, quickly, we have 1 minute left.
Yeah, one of the issues with the billing thing that's happening right now is because we fluctuated in the irrigation that was happening out in the community. So there is a great logic to do this just to regulate human behavior. The other part of this is that it's not Robert's decision. This is a city policy. And that's the exact kind of thing that the Water City speaks to. It's what the water management plan that SAWS will speak to. It's the reason why we need to be having these comprehensive conversations. I want to make sure water is available. Number one, bottom line, the revenue issue we will have to take care of through rate restructure.
Okay, any closing thoughts before we say thank you? All right, thank you, and thank our panelists.
That's a good question.
Good job.
Thank you all for coming today.
Good job.